Adjudicating the merits of a tort claim in this fashion violates due process. This court has placed several limitations on a trial court's discretion to strike pleadings. And in this case, there are two very concrete due process reasons why Relator is entitled to the writ at sea. In the first place, there was no previous sanction levied in this case. There wasn't even a previous request for one. If previous lesser sanctions are required in Texas, as this court's recent cases seem to indicate, then we need to go no further. But lesser sanctions should be required, even if they aren't now. Imposition of lesser sanctions provides the trial court with a very concrete tool with which the court can separate really bad, contumacious conduct from that conduct that just indicates negligence, mistake, or a difference of opinion.
Counsel, what should a trial court do after hearing the extensive testimony about alleged discovery abuse? Trial court makes a finding like Judge Curry made in this case that all of GTE's denials of responsibility for the telephone system which killed Rene Duran and injured for seven just as illegal for groundless and in bad faith. What is an appellate court to do when we have a finding and we have to struggle in Chrysler and Black about when there are findings of bad faith? How do we an appellate court review those findings, and is it a trial de novo? And if it is, what are the ramifications?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, as we've explained in our petition, even though this hearing lasted 7.5 hours, if you look at the evidence, there's no competent evidence to support those findings. But in the context of a sanction, due process requires that greater scrutiny be given to such findings. In a trial on the merits, the opportunity to completely explore all the issues satisfies due process and justifies deference being given to those trial court findings, just as deference is given to jury findings. But when there's been no opportunity to adjudicate the merits, when a party has all of its defenses stricken, because of allegations of two instances of misconduct, when there's been no misconduct before, no warnings, no prior sanctions, then the reviewing court has to, in order to preserve due process, give very great scrutiny to those findings.
Ms. Williams, but suppose one instance of misconduct is lying to the court. Are you saying that regardless of the nature of the misconduct, there has to be some sort of pattern established and Transamerican would require a lesser sanction to be imposed? And I've been looking at this and I have some trouble getting around it, but it appears that the real parties in interest are trying to urge before the judge, Judge Curry at least, and then Judge Tanner looked at the record, that GTE either intentionally didn't want to know and therefore didn't really go look at it, or they're saying in the worst case scenario, GTE knew that it was their stuff and they're trying to just hide the ball. I mean, they're arguing that this is not simply just sort of a discovery of abuse. They're arguing the facts before the trial court demonstrate intentional misrepresentation, lying to the trial court. That's what they're arguing. Now, looking at, they don't come right out and say it in their briefs, and it looks like they're saying they're torturing the process, but wouldn't you concede that if you walked up and were caught telling a fabrication to the judge that there'd be a little bit different review, different level of sanctioning than simply saying, well, we've just got a discovery dispute here and we need to try lesser sanctions first before we just drop the hammer?
I think that's the reason why sanctions need to be closely tailored. If a litigant and it would have to be the litigant, of course, lying to the court rather than the attorney, because the attorney, an appropriate sanction, of course, could be contempt or other sanctions that would properly punish the attorney. I think in a rare case where the record and the true facts, not just allegations and not just arguments, and not just assumptions about what a litigant knows or does not know, if the facts show that a litigant is bent on the course that it's been on, and that the only thing that will stop the abuse is a death penalty sanction, then a death penalty sanction should be imposed. But here, the record doesn't support that. The real parties have admitted that their experts didn't even form the opinions upon which the sanctions were based until long after the motion for summary judgment that's at issue was denied several months before. GTE had discovery requests out to the real parties asking for information that they had on product identification. Those responses were never answered. And as we've briefed, under those circumstances, to sanction a party by striking all of their pleadings because they contest product identification goes way beyond the bounds of due process.
Well, yeah, except their, I mean, their position is, I think, that GTE, simply by looking at the product, would have known it was theirs.
In a medical malpractice case, the defense expert says it's not negligent. The plaintiff's expert says, oh, but it is, and anyone but a fool would recognize that it is. Is that enough, you know, evidence upon which to base a death penalty sanction? And that's really what happened in this case, is that an individual testified under oath that, in his opinion, by looking at a piece, the only piece that's left of the hands that are very small, I think it's maybe about 3 or 4 inches long, looking at that and comparing that with some exemplars, he just knew that it was the product of my client, and that anybody could have known by looking at it. GTE produced evidence at the hearing from another expert that said that these generic-looking products are very difficult to identify. And so all that there is here is an assumption that the defendant should have known that it was liable for everything pled in the petition and just should have laid down and said so. And we didn't do that in this case. There's another reason, though, why death penalty sanctions in this particular case are improper, and that is because death penalty sanctions cannot be for deterrence or punishment alone. And that's what two of the findings in Judge Curry's order, findings 19 and 24, make very clear, that the sanction that was imposed was based on the speculative assumption that the relator was going to misbehave in the future, and that assumption was made without any pattern of misconduct upon which to base such an inference. All sanctions, in any shape or form, are punishment, and all sanctions promote deterrence. But here, the sanction deters the filing of any motion for summary judgment. It deters contesting product identification when the product involved has been absolutely destroyed. That kind of deterrence chills good faith advocacy and is another reason why death penalty sanctions should not and cannot be imposed for deterrence and punishment alone.
Counsel, in Chrysler versus Blackman, in this case, it is alleged by the relator, in this case as it was in that case, that the prevailing party tendered findings to the trial judge without showing them to the other side or allowing any contested hearing over what the findings should include. Do you know of any other way, other than a look at the entire record, that an appellate court can ascertain whether or not there is indeed any support for findings, assuming that the order here had included all of the findings that were required by Transamerica and its progeny?
I think that in any review of a case, evidentiary review, the appellate court has to look at the record and see if there is some evidence to support the findings. In our petition, we've gone through step by step to show that this is the unusual case where there is no competent evidence to support the findings of bad faith, to support the finding of a refusal to produce a document. Here, the uncontested evidence demonstrates that it was a document generated by another company, generated by a company with whom the defendant has no, they're subsidiaries, but there's no interrelationship between them such that the defendant here could demand production of the document from another. And so the lack of any evidence on those crucial factors should entitle us to relief, and the only way to determine that is to look at the record and the findings. But I think that has to be done even if this were an appeal from a trial on the merits before the court. There's an evidentiary review of the findings of fact and conclusions of law made by the trial court. What is important, I think, to remember is that the due process safeguards required by Transamerican in the later cases are questions of law. Whether or not the sanction is more severe than necessary, whether or not there's a direct relationship between the sanction and the alleged conduct, those are legal questions that should be reviewed de novo, regardless of whether the trial judge says this is there's a direct relationship between this sanction and the conduct. For example, here it's been alleged that the defendant relayed or filed a groundless motion for summary judgment. That motion was denied. Well, an appropriate just sanction might be ordering the abusing litigant to pay reasonable attorney's fees for responding to that motion, but giving the non-movement the equivalent of a summary judgment on the entire case turns due process on its ear. The same for the alleged denial of product identification. That's one preliminary element of the plaintiff's case. If indeed a litigant improperly denies a fact such as that, the fact can be deemed found in favor of the opponent. But certainly, that one denial shouldn't lead to a deeming of all facts found in favor of the opponent. I'd like to spend just a couple of minutes on some of the evidentiary points because I think that they're very important in this case. As far as the motion for summary judgment was concerned, the summary judgment evidence, the two affidavits that were supposedly filed in bad faith, have not to this day been controverted by real parties. Their witnesses on the stand testified that they could not contest the testimony in those affidavits that the relator used one particular type of cable in making its telephone handset, and a second affidavit that said that particular cable was not that type. Those two facts that are in those affidavits were not controverted by plaintiff's experts. In addition, the real parties have admitted, as I mentioned before, that their experts' opinions regarding product identification were not formulated until long after the motion for summary judgment was denied. At the time the motion was filed, there was no assertion that it was frivolous or groundless. And for those reasons, the summary judgment cannot violate Rule 13.
Does DTE still take the position that it didn't manufacture the cable?
Yes. That will be, I'm sure, if there is indeed a trial on the merits, a very hotly contested issue at trial. What is left is a very small piece of it. It's a generic product. The statement of facts in this case, there was a man testified by the name of Joe Craig, testified by deposition, that it would take an expert very familiar with a company's handsets and the component parts to identify them. One of the summary judgment affidavits was from a man who was employed by the company that made the cables that the defendant used. He testified very specifically about component parts that should have been in the product but are not here.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Tim Patton will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, I represent the real parties in interest, the Duran and the Ramirez families. The initial critical point in my view that I'd like to make today is this is just not one more discovery sanctions case. It's something much more. It's a serious Rule 13 violation, serious Rule 13 sanctions, in addition to being a discovery violation case. It's not one witness failing to show up for a depot like in Transamerica. It's not somebody not getting a few documents like in Chrysler or using an undesignated witness like in the Remington Arms case. This is a much more serious case. What we have here, as found by Judge Curry and is reaffirmed by Judge Tanner, is the defendant, GTE, who attempted to slide a summary judgment by a trial court when that defendant could not have, based upon a reasonable inquiry, have reasonably believed it was entitled to judgment as a matter of law. There is nothing more serious than attempting to deprive somebody of their right to a jury trial.
Was that motion contested?
The motion for summary judgment?
Was that answered?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I misunderstood Ms. Molina that there was no controverting affidavits or some critical facts in regards to that motion.
Oh, I disagree with that, and I've set out in my brief. I think we do controvert their expert testimony on the identity of the product. Absolutely, with deposition and affidavit testimony.
Is it your position you've identified the product as a matter of law?
No, I don't think we had to do that. I think what we had to show was that at the time GT filed this motion for summary judgment, it could not have, based upon reasonable inquiry, concluded it was entitled to judgment as a matter of law.
But if you have not established the identity of the product as a matter of law, if you have not established it as a matter of law, then why isn't it simply a fact issue left to be resolved by a trial by a jury? Why are we here on a Rule 13 sanction on a denial of a motion for summary judgment that you've controverted facts on, and now it's to go before a jury to make a determination?
Because we're not here on the aspect of Rule 13 that talks about groundlessness as a matter of fact. We're talking about groundlessness as a matter of law. They took the position they were entitled to judgment as a matter of law, and that was a frivolous position.
But it's frivolous only from the point of view that you say you have created a fact issue.
No, it's frivolous from the point of view that our proof at the sanctions proceeding shows that they could not, based on reasonable inquiry, have thought they were entitled to judgment as a matter of law. We may be talking by each other, but
maybe we are. If you haven't established, if you're saying they could not have said that it was not their product at the time they filed the motion for summary judgment, yet you have failed to establish it was their product as a matter of law, all you've done is say there's a fact issue on this issue. Well, if there's a fact issue, then doesn't that defeat your argument that they could not have formed the opinion that it wasn't their product?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. I mean, there's frequently I'm in cases where I know there's going to be a fact issue, but I know I'm not entitled to judgment as a matter of law. If I move for summary judgment in that case, it's not, I'm not entitled to judgment as a matter of law. I mean, it's a distinction between there being a fact issue and they're saying they're entitled to judgment as a matter of law. The key in this case is the motion for summary judgment.
Well, there are a lot of summary judgments filed in this state, and a lot of them are denied on the grounds that there is a fact question. Every time a motion is filed and it's denied because the trial judge finds there's a fact question, is that grounds for sanctions under Rule 13?
No.
How would you keep from having sanctions under Rule 13 if you could always argue that if the movement had simply asked the non-movement, is there a fact question in this case, and the non-movement had responded yes, he would have known better than to file a motion?
Yeah, I understand your concern. The difference in this case is there are two grounds for the sanctions imposed. The first ground is the product identification issue. The second ground is that GTE moved for summary judgment saying they were entitled to judgment as a matter of law because this accident was not foreseeable. They had in their possession a document which was directly contrary to their position on foreseeability and liability.
This company did.
Yes, as Judge Curry found, which I believe...
Did they have it as a matter of law, or is this just based on the evidence?
I think it's based on the evidence.
Could reasonable minds disagree on that subject?
On whether they had it?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I think they could have. But Judge Curry found that they did have it. They had it in their possession.
But if it went to a jury might not agree with Judge Curry.
Well, I don't think that the jury would ever be presented with a fact issue on whether GT ever had the document.
Aren't they going to be asked about foreseeability?
I think they will be, Your Honor.
And the jury might conclude in deciding foreseeability that they didn't have the document.
I would think it, I'm not sure I agree with that, Your Honor. I think that Judge Curry had basically resolved that issue. It's a disputed fact issue, which he resolved.
Well, how can he, why does he have the right to resolve that issue?
Again, you're talking at the, just so I'm clear, you're talking at the jury trial, assuming there is one.
One of the issues the jury's going to have to decide is foreseeability.
Yes.
And I assume in the process of trying to persuade the jury to answer that question one way or the other, the parties are going to take opposing positions on whether this party had that document. Isn't that a safe assumption?
I think that is a safe assumption.
And they're probably going to argue that at closing arguments, and the jury may believe or disbelieve one of the parties as to whether they had the document or not. Based on that decision, they may decide that this was foreseeable or not foreseeable. Why isn't that something that the jury is supposed to decide in this case and not the trial judge?
Because in this case, the judge decided that the failure to furnish that document was an abuse of the discovery process. So he was entitled to make that decision.
But it was on controverted evidence.
It was on controverted evidence. I think Justice Gonzalez got to the heart of the matter. This is a standard of review case.
Well, that concerns me, Mr. Patton, because the allegation here is made, as I alluded to my question, Ms. Molina, that GTE was not served with a copy of the proposed findings or sanction order before Judge Curry signed it. And that was the same allegation made in Chrysler versus Blackman. How are we to know other than by reviewing the evidence underlying that finding under those circumstances, whether in fact the trial judge has actually made that finding or one side just happened to slip the order in without serving it on the opposing counsel and there really was no opportunity for a hearing over what the content of that order is?
I think their allegation is that Judge Curry signed the findings without giving them an opportunity to object. They were served on the same run. I don't know when Judge Curry signed.
After he signed it?
Yes. I did. It's outside the record, but it was a run where it went to the court and then it went to opposing counsel.
Other than an appellate court looking at the evidence, I mean, if there's no hearing on what the content of the order is, then presumably if the evidence supports the findings, then the appellate court will say so. But if it doesn't support the findings, how are we supposed to defer to the trial court's decision on these contested findings when there's actually no opportunity for a hearing to argue what should be included in the order?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, their position presupposes that the findings, which plaintiff's counsel prepared, I prepared them, were my findings and not the court's. In Dyckman versus Snell, this court said that once they're signed by the trial court, they're the court's findings. It's presumed that he looked at them and he thought about it. Second of all, they did do a motion to reconsider those findings of fact, and Judge Curry told them that he had read the findings, he had thought about it, and he wasn't inclined to disturb them. So they had an opportunity to challenge them. They thought it was a cursory opportunity. I disagree. the findings or the particulars as they are in this case. Our position is that they're entitled to great deference under Walker versus Packer because they almost all involve resolution of disputed fact issues. Whether GT engaged in a reasonable inquiry, whether they're guilty of flagrant bad faith, whether they acted in callous disregard, those are inextricably intertwined to the credibility of the witnesses and the facts of the case. Those are fact-specific judgment calls. I think even the appropriate sanction in this case is to some extent a mixed question of law and fact because it's so tied to credibility, reasonableness, and bad faith.
Is it true that there have been no previous sanctions?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
And none even requested?
True. So in this case, I think those findings are entitled to deference. And what I'd like to point out, what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Cooter versus Jell, which is cited in our brief, and what that court said basically was, it's impossible to have a pure question of law in a sanctions case because it's so tied to the witnesses, assuming it's a contested hearing and there's evidence. So in most cases, you're going to give a lot of deference to the trial court. And this is the aspect, although it's touched on in Chrysler, I don't think this court has really discussed in great detail before.
Does a parent corporation always have a superior right of possession and thus a duty to produce a document which is actually held by a subsidiary corporation? That's the allegation made here.
Absolutely not, but that's not why Judge Curry said they had care, custody, and control.
Could you expand on that?
Sure. What Judge Curry based his decision on was a testimony of a Charles James, who they refer to as our expert. He's not a paid expert. He's the president of a former defendant in the case. James had years of experience in the payphone industry. He had worked with GTE as a supplier. He had negotiated to buy the GTE payphone division. They had negotiated to buy his outfit, ATS. He had personal knowledge of the matter in which the various GTE entities share information, their access to information. He testified that it was inconceivable that GTE, did not have a copy of this memo. So it's totally inconceivable they had to have had it.
He did not know that they had it.
Well, no, I don't think he had personal knowledge that it was in their hands.
Was he a former employee of GTE?
No, he's not. He basically would be an expert based on experience.
But he was an outsider as far as how GTE handled their communications between the companies.
In terms of being a non-GTE employee, I'd agree with that. In terms of having extensive experience with
all...
Or
just his idea that it was inconceivable?
His idea based on extensive experience and knowledge of how the GTE entities work and communicate with one another. But we get back to the point about the standard of review. Whether Mr. James was qualified as an expert under Rule 705, that's something committed to the discretion of the trial court. Whether GT had possession of that document, that's a disputed fact issue.
Well, your view of it is that if opposing counsel asks you, for example, your client to produce information and you produce some, but it turns out later that another document is produced, you say it was overlooked, and if opposing counsel produces another lawyer who says, I used to be a partner with the counsel and I know how he works and it's inconceivable that this could have been overlooked. If the judge believes that, then he can sanction you appropriately and there is no appellate review of that.
I think that's going to be, like the Supreme Court said in Cooter and Jell, that's a fact-specific ruling. I think it depends on all the evidence. Here,
but if the evidence goes like it did in this case, then you're going to be stuck with sanctions.
If there's somebody who testifies for 50 pages in a statement of facts about why I had that document, and
why you must have had it, why it's inconceivable that you shouldn't have had it and produced it.
If there's proof like this, yes, I'm on the hook. I get sanctioned.
Well, even though you have an expert opining on that critical issue, all expert testimony has to be based on something. And here, wouldn't it be, what would it be based on other than just speculation?
I think it goes to his knowledge and experience, Your Honor, having had personal dealings for years with the GTE entities. And we're talking about a man who went to the GTE payphone division in Birmingham, Alabama, and went through the GTE, basically a big bidding conference. You know, this man knows a lot about the company. This isn't somebody who just walked in and two pages of the statement of facts said, well, it's my opinion that they had the document and walked out.
But you would agree with me that if an expert renders an opinion on this issue, that GTE must have had it, that it has to be based on evidence.
Oh, absolutely.
It can't be just based on a bare opinion.
No, even though Rule 704 would allow that opinion, maybe, I don't think you could do that. You'd have to have some factual basis for the ultimate opinion.
And you have that in this record?
Yes. GTE also argues, basically, that we should lose because the trial court never expressly invoked the presumption that its defendants lack merit. Its defenses lack merit. First of all, though, there is no express particular to that effect. It's clear from the tenor of Judge Curry's 24 particulars that he felt it would be manifestly unjust to allow GTE to present evidence on those defenses after it withheld evidence on those defenses. And that's really the key of that presumption. If you look at the Society International case, which is cited in Transamerican, quoted in Transamerican from where this presumption arises, what the court is basically saying is that at some point, if you've withheld evidence, and it's egregious enough, we're going to invoke a presumption, and you don't get to put on the proof pertaining to that evidence. But more importantly, that presumption really doesn't fit in this case, and it's not applicable in every case. Usually that presumption is invoked when you have a discrete issue, discrete discovery issue, and you can relate the concealed evidence to some defense. What we have here is a sanction or abusive conduct going to the entire case. There's also no constitutional requirement that this presumption be in every case. And in Transamerican, this court recognized that the U.S. Supreme Court and National Hockey League assessed a death penalty sanction without invoking that presumption.
How did the real party in interest discover this incriminating evidence that they were withholding? Was it finally turned over to you?
No, it was never produced by GTE. It surfaced during the deposition of a former third-party defendant in the case, the president of Allentel Company. They were brought in by GTE. He was deposed, subpoenaed to Satik, and we produced the document. And that's how I understand we found it.
Does the record have any testimony of anyone who says that they know for sure that this particular instrument was a GTE instrument because they have the records of how it was purchased and how it was installed? Was there any of that kind of direct evidence in your record?
I would say yes. I'd say they'd probably say no. The evidence is that this Mr. James is the person who purchased the payphone at Bud's Food Liner. He unpackaged it, and he installed it at Bud's Food Liner. So he knew it was completely a GTE phone when he put it in Bud's Food Liner. There's also testimony.
There's his testimony to that fact, that it was GTE?
Yes. And then there was testimony from a Mr. Chavez 3 or 4 days before the incident resulting in Renee Duran's death, in which he moved the phone from inside the store to outside the store, and he testified it was a GTE product. So we know it was a GTE product at least for sure 3 days before the death. They dispute that, but that is our evidence, our expert testimony.
But again, this is evidence that a jury might choose to disbelieve after
yes,
they hear both sides.
After they hear both, they might choose to disbelieve, but again, the critical inquiry is at the time they filed that motion for summary judgment, could they have reason to believe they were entitled to judgment as a matter of law?
Mr. Patton, how long after your request did you ultimately acquire the contested document?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I don't believe it's in the record.
And why wouldn't the assessment of
financial sanction make your client whole? You got the document.
I guess the answer to that, Your Honor, is that at some point an abuse of the judicial process is so great that you're entitled to do a death penalty sanction. That's essentially what the U.S. Supreme Court said in Roadway Express, which is not cited in my brief, at 100 Supreme Court 2455.
Is your client entitled to a death penalty sanction to protect the judicial process or to protect itself?
I think a sanction can serve multi-purposes. It can serve a reimbursement, a compensation purpose. It can serve deterrence. It can serve as punishment. And in response to what they were saying about the necessity of a lesser sanction, there is no constitutional requirement that a lesser sanction must be imposed first.
Isn't there that requirement in our cases explicitly in Chrysler and Transamerica?
I would disagree with that. I mean, you wrote Chrysler, so you know better than I. But I view Chrysler and Transamerican as saying that a lesser sanction must be considered. Surely,
trial judge got to think about it a second before he lets the hammer down.
Well, hopefully he thinks about it for more than a second. But surely there can be such an egregious abuse of the process that you don't have to do a lesser sanction.
Any other questions? Thank you,
Thank
counsel. May it please the court. It's unclear what is a litigant supposed to do. Rule 13 requires a reasonable inquiry before filing a pleading. In this case, the defendant had outstanding discovery requests concerning product identification precisely because the product was in the shape it was. This is not a product that had the defendant's name on it. The defendant goes out, talks to two disinterested witnesses, one a former employee and another an employee of another company. One witness says, when I worked for the defendant, we only used general cable cords in our product. The general cable employee makes a very detailed examination of the cord, says this isn't a general cable cord because the terminals are different, the wires are different, there are differences in it. Hearing nothing from real parties about anything on product identification, part of the motion for summary judgment included the ground with those affidavits that we didn't make the product. Those facts and those affidavits concerning the comparison that was made and whether what supplier the defendant used, those facts have not been controverted. What was attached to the motion for summary judgment was an affidavit from the same man who testified at trial that said this must be the defendant's handset because it was attached to the defendant's housing. There was also evidence in the record that these parts had been switched out. As for Mr. James's testimony concerning the document, I refer the court to pages 122 to 23, page 125, and pages 133 to 34 of the statement of facts in which he testified unequivocally that he had no personal knowledge about whether or not the defendant could compel production of that document from the Florida companies that generated it. It was a Florida GTE of Florida company, yes, a subsidiary of a large corporation like the defendant, but it was that company that generated the document, and the record is also uncontroverted that that document was generated after the defendant went out of the payphone manufacturing business in August of 1986, I believe it was, but it's in the statement of facts. So this is a document that wasn't even generated while the defendant would have had a reason to obtain it. As for the, there's been several questions regarding the standard of review. Whether or not these findings are reviewed de novo or given some sort of deference has to be subsumed in a due process analysis. Here, many of those findings that Judge Curry signed are not fact findings. Whether or not a defendant is in bad faith is a legal conclusion, a legal opinion that is, yes, based on facts. But here, there's nothing in this record to indicate that the defendant was in bad faith at all. This case was set for trial in July of 1991. It was continued by agreement till September of 1991. The motion for sanctions, quite frankly, came out of the blue. As to whether the motion for summary judgment or any motion for summary judgment can subject a litigant to Rule 13 sanctions, it should be the law in Texas that such a motion cannot subject a defendant to sanctions unless there is unequivocal testimony that there was knowledge of the controverting proof at the time the motion was filed. That's what the federal courts do. Federal courts allow sanctions for motions, frivolous motions for summary judgment, but they base such sanctions on evidence such as that the defendant knew of the testimony that they were faced with. Quite frankly, it should not be the law in Texas that a contested issue, and it turned out to be contested after the motion for summary judgment was filed, that litigation of that issue shouldn't occur in the context of a sanctions hearing. The credibility of the witnesses on those facts, whether or not my client made the product, that's credibility on issues going to the merits, and the jury should resolve those, not the trial court, with all due respect, in the context of a sanctions hearing.
Under the evidence of this case, couldn't Judge Curry have concluded that GTE knew of the controverting information before it filed the motion for summary judgment?
I don't see how, when Mr. James and Dr. Eftekar both admitted on the stand that they didn't even formulate these opinions until June of 1991, the hearing on the motion for summary judgment was in April of 1991, and we had received no responses to our request.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the second argument. The court will now take another brief recess.
Please rise.